He wants to drop in. She said nothing. He busied himself emptying ashtrays that contained a single match or one butt, gathering newspapers, adding a log to the fire that did not need it, lighting more lamps. He whistled a tune from a screen operetta. He ran to open the door when he heard the bell.
"How nice," said Tui, coming in. "A fire and just the two of you. Hello, Dominique. Hope I'm not intruding."
"Hello, Ellsworth," she said. "You're never intruding," said Keating. "I can't tell you how glad I am to see you." He pushed a chair to the fire. "Sit down here, Ellsworth. What'll you have? You know, when I heard your voice on the phone, well, I wanted to jump and yelp like a pup."
"Don't wag your tail, though," said Tui. "No, no drinks, thanks. How have you been, Dominique?"
"Just as I was a year ago," she said.
"But not as you were 2 years ago."
"No." "What did we do 2 years ago this time?" Keating asked, idly.
"You weren't married," said Tui. "Prehistorical period. Let me see, what happened then?" "I think the Stoddard Temple was just being completed."
"Oh, that," said Keating. Tui asked,
"Hear anything about your friend Rourke, Peter?"
"No, I don't think he's worked for a year or more. He's finished this time."
"Yes, I think so. What have you been doing, Peter?"
"Nothing much. Oh, I've just read The Gallant Gallstone."
"Liked it?"
"Yes. You know, I think it's a very important book, because it's true that there's no such thing as free will. We can't help what we are or what we do. It's not our fault. Nobody's to blame for anything. It's all in your background and your glands. If you're good, that's no achievement of yours. You were just lucky in your glands. If you're rotten, nobody should punish you. You were unlucky, that's all." He was saying it defiantly, with a violence inappropriate to a literary discussion. He was not looking at Tui, nor at Dominique, but speaking to the room, and to what that room had witnessed.
"Substantially correct," said Tui.
"To be logical, however, we should not think of punishment for those who are rotten,
since they suffered through no fault of their own, since they were unlucky and underendowed. They should deserve a compensation of some sort, more like a reward."
"Why, yes," cried Keating. That's logical."
"And just," said Tui.
"Got the banner pretty much where you want it, Ellsworth?" asked Dominique.
"What's that in reference to?"
"The Gallant Gallstone."
"Oh. No, I can't say I have. Not quite. There are always the imponderables."
"What are you talking about?" asked Keating.
"Professional gossip," said Tui.
He stretched his hands to the fire and flexed his fingers playfully.
"By the way, Peter, are you doing anything about Stone Ridge?"
"God damn it," said Keating.
"What's the matter?"
"You know what's the matter. You know the bastard better than I do. To have a project like that going up now when it's manna in the desert. And of all people to have that son of a bitch Winand doing it."
"What's the matter with Mr. Winand?"
"Oh, come, Ellsworth. You know very well if it were anyone else I'd get that commission just like that." He snapped his fingers. "I wouldn't even have to ask. The owner'd come to me. Particularly when he knows that an architect like me is practically sitting on his fanny now compared to the work our office could handle. But Mr. Gale Winand, you'd think he was a holy llama who's just allergic to the air breathed by architects."
"I gather you've tried?"
"Oh, don't talk about it. It makes me sick. I think I've spent $300 feeding lunches and pouring liquor into all sorts of crappy people who said they could get me to meet him. All I got is hangovers. I think it'd be easier to meet the Pope."
"I gather you do want to get Stone Ridge?"
"Are you baiting me, Ellsworth? I'd give my right arm for it."
"That wouldn't be advisable. You couldn't make any drawings then, or pretend to. It would be preferable to give up something less tangible."
"I'd give my soul."
"Would you, Peter?" asked Dominique.
"What's on your mind, Ellsworth?" Keating snapped.
"Just a practical suggestion," said Tui. "Who has been your most effective salesman in the past and got you some of your best commissions?"
"Why, Dominique, I guess."
"That's right. And since you can't get to Winand, and it wouldn't do you any good if you did, don't you think Dominique is the one who'll be able to persuade him?"
Keating stared at him. "Are you crazy, Ellsworth?" Dominique leaned forward. She seemed interested.
From what I've heard, she said, Gail Wynand does not do favors for a woman unless she's beautiful. And if she's beautiful, he doesn't do it as a favor.
Tui looked at her, underscoring the fact that he offered no denial.
It's silly, snapped Keating angrily. How would Dominique ever get to see him?
By telephoning his office and making an appointment, said Tui.
Whoever told you he'd grant it?
He did.
When?
Late last night. Or early this morning, to be exact.
Ellsworth, gasped Keating.
He added,
I don't believe it.
I do, said Dominique. Or Ellsworth wouldn't have started this conversation.
She smiled at Tui.
So Wynand promised you to see me?
Yes, my dear.
How did you work that?
Oh, I offered him a convincing argument. However, it would be advisable not to delay it. You should telephone him tomorrow, if you wish to do it.
Why can't she telephone now? Said Keating.
Oh, I guess it's too late.
You'll telephone first thing in the morning?
She looked at him, her eyes half closed, and said nothing.
It's a long time since you've taken any active interest in Peter's career, said Tui. Wouldn't you like to undertake a difficult feat like that, for Peter's sake?
If Peter wants me to.
If I want you to? Cried Keating. Are you both crazy? It's the chance of a lifetime.
He saw them both looking at him curiously. He snapped,
Oh, rubbish!
What is rubbish, Peter? Asked Dominique.
Are you going to be stopped by a lot of fool gossip? Why, any other architect's wife would crawl on her hands and knees for a chance like that to—
No other architect's wife would be offered the chance, said Tui.
No other architect has a wife like Dominique. You've always been so proud of that, Peter.
Dominique can take care of herself in any circumstances.
There's no doubt about that.
All right, Ellsworth, said Dominique. I'll telephone Wynand tomorrow.
Ellsworth, you're wonderful, said Keating, not looking at her.
I believe I'd like a drink now, said Tui. We should celebrate.
When Keating hurried out to the kitchen, Tui and Dominique looked at each other. He smiled. He glanced at the door through which Keating had gone, then nodded to her faintly, amused.
You expected it, said Dominique.
Of course.
Now what's the real purpose, Ellsworth?
Why, I wanted to help you get Stone Ridge for Peter. It's really a terrific commission.
Why are you so anxious to have me sleep with Wynand?
Don't you think it would be an interesting experience for all concerned?
You're not satisfied with the way my marriage has turned out, are you, Ellsworth?
Not entirely. Just about 50%. Well, nothing's perfect in this world. One gathers what one can, and then one tries further.
You were very anxious to have Peter marry me. You knew what the result would be, better than Peter or I.
Peter didn't know it at all.
Well, it worked. 50%. You got Peter Keating where you wanted him, the leading architect of the country who's now mud clinging to your galoshes.
I've never liked your style of expression, but it's always been accurate. I should have said, who's now a soul wagging its tail. Your style is gentler.
But the other 50%, Ellsworth? A failure?
Approximately total. My fault. I should have known better than to expect anyone like Peter Keating, even in the role of husband, to destroy you.
Well, you're frank.
I told you once it's the only method that will work with you. Besides, surely it didn't take you 2 years to discover what I wanted of this marriage.
So you think Gail Wynand will finish the job?
Might. What do you think?
I think I'm only a side issue again. Didn't you call it gravy once? What have you got against Wynand?
He laughed. The sound betrayed that he had not expected the question. She said contemptuously,
Don't show that you're shocked, Ellsworth.
All right. We're taking it straight. I have nothing specific against Mr. Gail Wynand. I've been planning to have him meet you for a long time. If you want minor details, he did something that annoyed me yesterday morning. He's too observant. So I decided the time was right.
And there was Stone Ridge.
and there was Stonebridge. I knew that part of it would appeal to you. You'd never sell yourself to save your country, your soul, or the life of a man you loved. But you'll sell yourself to get a commission he doesn't deserve for Peter Keating. See what will be left of you afterward. Or of Gail Wynand. I'll be interested to see it, too.
Quite correct, Ellsworth.
All of it? Even the part about a man you loved? If you did.
Yes.
You wouldn't sell yourself for Rourke? Though, of course, you don't like to hear that name pronounced.
Howard Rourke, she said evenly.
You have a great deal of courage, Dominique.
Keating returned, carrying a tray of cocktails. His eyes were feverish, and he made too many gestures. Toohey raised his glass. He said,
"To Gail Wynand and the New York Banner, Chapter 3.
Gail Wynand rose and met her halfway across his office.
"How do you do, Mrs. Keating?" he said.
"How do you do, Mr. Wynand?" said Dominique.
He moved a chair for her, but when she sat down he did not cross to sit behind his desk. He stood studying her professionally, appraisingly. His manner implied a self-evident necessity, as if his reason were known to her, and there could be nothing improper in this behavior.
"You look like a stylized version of your own stylized version," he said. "As a rule, seeing the models of artworks tends to make one atheistic, but this time it's a close one between that sculptor and God."
"What sculptor?"
"The one who did that statue of you."
He had felt that there was some story behind that statue, and he became certain of it now by something in her face, a tightening that contradicted for a second the trim indifference of her self-control.
"Where and when did you see that statue, Mr. Wynand?"
"In my art gallery, this morning."
"Where did you get it?"
It was his turn to show perplexity.
"But don't you know that?"
"No."
"Your friend Ellsworth Toohey sent it to me. As a present."
"To get this appointment for me?"
"Not through as direct a motivation as I believe you're thinking. But in substance, yes."
"He hasn't told me that."
"Do you mind my having that statue?"
"Not particularly."
"I expected you to say that you were delighted."
"I'm not."
He sat down, informally, on the outer edge of his desk, his legs stretched out, his ankles crossed. He asked,
"I gather you lost track of that statue and have been trying to find it?"
"For 2 years."
"You can't have it."
He added, watching her.
"You might have Stonebridge."
"I shall change my mind. I'm delighted that Toohey gave it to you."
He felt a bitter little stab of triumph, and of disappointment, in thinking that he could read her mind, and that her mind was obvious after all. He asked,
"Because it gave you this interview?"
"No, because you're the person before last in the world whom I'd like to have that statue. But Toohey is last."
He lost the triumph. It was not a thing which a woman intent on Stonebridge should have said or thought.
He asked, "You didn't know that Toohey had it?"
"No."
"We should get together on our mutual friend, Mr. Ellsworth Toohey. I don't like being a pawn, and I don't think you do, or could ever be made to. There are too many things Mr. Toohey chose not to tell. The name of that sculptor, for instance."
"He didn't tell you that?"
"No."
"Stephen Mallory."
"Mallory? Not the one who tried to—" He laughed aloud.
"What's the matter?"
"Toohey told me he couldn't remember the name. That name."
"Does Mr. Toohey still astonish you?"
"He has several times in the last few days. There's a special kind of subtlety in being as blatant as he's been. A very difficult kind. I almost like his artistry."
"I don't share your taste."
"Not in any field? Not in sculpture? Or architecture?"
"I'm sure not in architecture."
"Isn't that the utterly wrong thing for you to say?"
"Probably."
He looked at her. He said,
"You're interesting."
"I didn't intend to be."
"That's your third mistake."
"Third?"
"The first was about Mr. Toohey. In the circumstances, one would expect you to praise him to me, to quote him,
to lean on his great prestige in matters of architecture? But one would expect you to know Ellsworth Tuohy. That should disqualify any quotations.
I intended to say that to you. Had you given me the chance, you won't give me.
That should make it more entertaining.
You expected to be entertained?
I am.
About this statue?
It was the only point of weakness he had discovered.
No.
Her voice was hard. Not about the statue.
Tell me, when was it made, and for whom?
Is that another thing Mr. Tuohy forgot?
Apparently.
Do you remember a scandal about a building called the Stoddard Temple? 2 years ago. You were away at the time.
The Stoddard Temple. How do you happen to know where I was 2 years ago?
Wait, the Stoddard Temple, I remember.
A sacrilegious church or some such object that gave the Bible Brigade a howling spree.
Yes.
There was...
He stopped. His voice sounded hard and reluctant, like hers.
There was the statue of a naked woman involved.
Yes.
I see.
He was silent for a moment. Then he said, his voice harsh, as if he were holding back some anger whose object she could not guess.
I was somewhere around Bali at the time. I'm sorry all New York saw that statue before I did, but I don't read newspapers when I'm sailing. There's a standing order to fire any man who brings a wine and paper aboard the yacht.
Have you ever seen pictures of the Stoddard Temple?
No. Was the building worth the statue?
The statue was almost worthy of the building.
It has been destroyed, hasn't it?
Yes. With the help of the wine and papers.
He shrugged. I remember Alva Skerritt had a good time with it. A big story. Sorry I missed it. But Alva did very well. Incidentally, how did you know that I was away, and why has the fact of my absence remained in your memory?
It was the story that cost me my job with you.
Your job? With me?
Didn't you know my name was Dominique Francone?
Under the trim jacket, his shoulders made a sagging movement forward. It was surprise and helplessness. He stared at her quite simply. After a while, he said, "No."
She smiled indifferently. She said, "It appears that Tuohy wanted to make it as difficult for both of us as he could."
"To hell with Tuohy. This has to be understood. It doesn't make sense." "You're Dominique Francone?"
"I was."
"You worked here in this building for years?"
"For 6 years."
"Why haven't I met you before?"
"I'm sure you don't meet every one of your employees."
"I think you understand what I mean."
"Do you wish me to state it for you?"
"Yes."
"Why haven't I tried to meet you before?"
"Yes."
"I had no desire to."
"That, precisely, doesn't make sense."
"Shall I let this go by, or understand it?"
"I'll spare you the choice. With the kind of beauty you possess, and with knowledge of the kind of reputation I am said to possess, why didn't you attempt to make a real career for yourself on the Banner?"
"I never wanted a real career on the Banner."
"Why?"
"Perhaps for the same reason that makes you forbid wine and papers on your yacht."
"It's a good reason," he said quietly.
Then he asked, his voice casual again,
"Let's see, what was it you did to get fired? You went against our policy, I believe."
"I tried to defend the Stoddard Temple."
"Didn't you know better than to attempt sincerity on the Banner?"
"I intended to say that to you, if you'd given me the chance."
"Are you being entertained?"
"I wasn't, then. I liked working here."
"You're the only one who's ever said that in this building."
"I must be one of two."
"Who's the other?"
"Yourself, Mr. Winand."
"Don't be too sure of that."
Lifting his head, he saw the hint of amusement in her eyes and asked,
"You said it just to trap me into that kind of a statement?"
"Yes, I think so," she answered placidly.
"Dominique Francone," he repeated, not addressing her. "I used to like your stuff. I almost wish you were here to ask for your old job."
"I'm here to discuss Stone Ridge."
"Ah, yes. Of course."
He settled back to enjoy a long speech of persuasion. He thought it would be interesting to hear what arguments she'd choose and how she'd act in the role of petitioner.
Well, what do you wish to tell me about that?
I should like you to give that commission to my husband. I understand, of course, that there's no reason why you should do so, unless I agree to sleep with you in exchange. If you consider that a sufficient reason, I am willing to do it. He looked at her silently, allowing no hint of personal reaction in his face. She sat looking up at him, faintly astonished by his scrutiny, as if her words had deserved no special attention. He could not force on himself, though he was seeking it fiercely, any other impression of her face than the incongruous one of undisturbed purity. He said,
"That is what I was to suggest, but not so crudely and not on our first meeting.
I have saved you time and lies."
"You love your husband very much?"
"I despise him."
"You have a great faith in his artistic genius?"
"I think he's a third-rate architect."
"Then why are you doing this?"
"It amuses me."
"I thought I was the only one who acted on such motives."
"You shouldn't mind. I don't believe you've ever found originality a desirable virtue, Mr. Wynand."
"Actually, you don't care whether your husband gets Stone Ridge or not?"
"No."
"And you have no desire to sleep with me?"
"None at all."
"I could admire a woman who'd put on an act like that." "Only it's not an act."
"It's not. Please don't begin admiring me. I have tried to avoid it."
Whenever he smiled, no obvious movement was required of his facial muscles. The hint of mockery was always there, and it merely came into sharper focus for a moment, to recede imperceptibly again. The focus was sharper now. "As a matter of fact," he said, "your chief motive is I, after all. The desire to give yourself to me."
He saw the glance she could not control, and added,
"No, don't enjoy the thought that I have fallen into so gross an error. I didn't mean it in the usual sense, but in its exact opposite. Didn't you say you considered me the person before last in the world?" "You don't want Stone Ridge. You want to sell yourself for the lowest motive to the lowest person you can find."
"I didn't expect you to understand that," she said simply.
"You want..." "Men do that sometimes, not women. To express through the sexual act your utter contempt for me."
"No, Mr. Wynand. For myself."
The thin line of his mouth moved faintly, as if his lips had caught the first hint of a personal revelation, an involuntary one, and therefore a weakness, and were holding it tight while he spoke. Most people go to very great length in order to convince themselves of their self-respect.
"Yes."
"And, of course, a quest for self-respect is proof of its lack."
"Yes."
"Do you see the meaning of a quest for self-contempt?"
"That I lack it."
"And that you'll never achieve it."
"I didn't expect you to understand that either."
"I won't say anything else, or I'll stop being the person before last in the world and I'll become unsuitable to your purpose." He rose. "Shall I tell you formally that I accept your offer?" She inclined her head in agreement. "As a matter of fact," he said, "I don't care whom I choose to build Stone Ridge. I've never hired a good architect for any of the things I've built. I give the public what it wants. I was stuck for a choice this time because I'm tired of the bunglers who've worked for me, and it's hard to decide without standards or reason. I'm sure you don't mind my saying this. I'm really grateful to you for giving me a much better motive than any I could hope to find."
"I'm glad you didn't say that you've always admired the work of Peter Keating.
You didn't tell me how glad you were to join the distinguished list of Gail Winans' mistresses."
"You may enjoy my admitting it if you wish, but I think we'll get along very well together."
"Quite likely. At least you've given me a new experience, to do what I've always done, but honestly. Shall I now begin to give you my orders? I won't pretend they're anything else."
"If you wish."
"You'll go with me for a 2 months cruise on my yacht. We'll sail in 10 days. When we come back, you'll be free to return to your husband, with the contract for Stone Ridge."
"Very well."
"I should like to meet your husband. Will you both have dinner with me Monday night?"
"Yes, if you wish."
When she rose to leave, he asked,
Shall I tell you the difference between you and your statue?
No.
But I want to. It's startling to see the same elements used in two compositions with opposite themes. Everything about you in that statue is the theme of exaltation. But your own theme is suffering.
Suffering?
I'm not conscious of having shown that. You haven't. That's what I meant. No happy person can be quite so impervious to pain.
Wynand telephoned his art dealer and asked him to arrange a private showing of Stephen Mallory's work. He refused to meet Mallory in person. He never met those whose work he liked. The art dealer executed the order in great haste. Wynand bought 5 of the pieces he saw and paid more than the dealer had hoped to ask.
"Mr. Mallory would like to know," said the dealer, "what brought him to your attention?"
"I saw one of his works."
"Which one?"
"It doesn't matter."
Tui had expected Wynand to call for him after the interview with Dominique. Wynand had not called. But a few days later, meeting Tui by chance in the city room, Wynand asked aloud,
"Mr. Tui, have so many people tried to kill you that you can't remember their names?"
Tui smiled and said, "I'm sure quite so many would like to."
"You flatter your fellow men," said Wynand, walking away.
Peter Keating stared at the brilliant room of the restaurant. It was the most exclusive place in town and the most expensive. Keating gloated, chewing the thought that he was here as the guest of Gail Wynand. He tried not to stare at the gracious elegance of Wynand's figure across the table. He blessed Wynand for having chosen to give this dinner in a public place. People were gaping at Wynand, discreetly and with practiced camouflage, but gaping nevertheless. And their attention included the two guests at Wynand's table. Dominique sat between the two men. She wore a white silk dress with long sleeves and a cowl neck, a nun's garment that acquired the startling effect of an evening gown only by being so flagrantly unsuited to that purpose. She wore no jewelry. Her gold hair looked like a hood. The dull white silk moved in angular planes with the movements of her body, revealing it in a manner of cold innocence. The body of a sacrificial object publicly offered, beyond the need of concealment or desire. Keating found it unattractive. He noticed that Wynand seemed to admire it. Someone at a distant table stared in their direction insistently. Someone tall and bulky. Then the big shape rose to its feet, and Keating recognized Ralston Holcomb hurrying toward them.
"Peter, my boy, so glad to see you," boomed Holcomb, shaking his hand, bowing to Dominique, conspicuously ignoring Wynand. "Where have you been hiding? Why don't we see you around any more?"
They had had luncheon together 3 days ago. Wynand had risen and stood leaning forward a little, courteously. Keating hesitated, then, with obvious reluctance, said, "Mr. Wynand, Mr. Holcomb."
"Not Mr. Gale Wynand," said Holcomb, with splendid innocence.
"Mr. Holcomb, if you saw one of the cough-drop Smith brothers in real life, would you recognize him?" asked Wynand.
"Why, I guess so," said Holcomb, blinking.
"My face, Mr. Holcomb, is just as much of a public bromide."
Holcomb muttered a few benevolent generalities and escaped. Wynand smiled affectionately. "You didn't have to be afraid of introducing Mr. Holcomb to me, Mr. Keating, even though he is an architect."
"Afraid, Mr. Wynand?"
"Unnecessarily, since it's all settled. Hasn't Mrs. Keating told you that Stone Ridge is yours?"
"I..."
"No, she hasn't told me."
"I didn't know."
Wynand was smiling, but the smile remained fixed, and Keating felt compelled to go on talking until some sign stopped him.
"I hadn't quite hoped. Not so soon. Of course I thought this dinner might be a sign. Help you to decide."
He blurted out involuntarily,
"Do you always throw surprises like that? Just like that?"
"Whenever I can," said Wynand gravely.
"I shall do my best to deserve this honor and live up to your expectations, Mr. Wynand."
"I have no doubt about that," said Wynand. He had said little to Dominique tonight. His full attention seemed centered on Keating.
The public has been kind to my past endeavors, said Keating. But I shall make Stone Ridge my best achievement.
That is quite a promise, considering the distinguished list of your works. I had not hoped that my works were of sufficient importance to attract your attention, Mr. Winant. But I know them quite well. The Cosmo Slotnick building, which is pure Michelangelo.
Keating's face spread in incredulous pleasure. He knew that Winant was a great authority on art, and would not make such comparisons lightly.
The Prudential Bank building, which is genuine Palladio, the Slattern department store, which is snitched Christopher Wren.
Keating's face had changed. Look what an illustrious company I get for the price of one. Isn't it quite a bargain?
Keating smiled, his face tight, and said, I've heard about your brilliant sense of humor, Mr. Winant.
Have you heard about my descriptive style?
What do you mean?
Winant half turned in his chair and looked at Dominique, as if he were inspecting an inanimate object.
Your wife has a lovely body, Mr. Keating. Her shoulders are too thin, but admirably in scale with the rest of her. Her legs are too long, but that gives her the elegance of line you'll find in a good yacht. Her breasts are beautiful, don't you think?
Architecture is a crude profession, Mr. Winant. Keating tried to laugh. It doesn't prepare one for the superior sort of sophistication.
You don't understand me, Mr. Keating?
If I didn't know you were a perfect gentleman, I might misunderstand it. But you can't fool me.
That is just what I'm trying not to do.
I appreciate compliments, Mr. Winant, but I'm not conceited enough to think that we must talk about my wife.
Why not, Mr. Keating? It is considered good form to talk of the things one has, or will have, in common.
Mr. Winant, I don't understand.
Shall I be more explicit?
No.
Shall we drop the subject of Stone Ridge?
Oh, let's talk about Stone Ridge.
But we are, Mr. Keating.
Keating looked at the room about them. He thought that things like this could not be done in such a place. The fastidious magnificence made it monstrous. He wished it were a dank cellar. He thought blood on paving stones. All right, but not blood on a drawing-room rug.
Now I know this is a joke, Mr. Winant, he said. It is my turn to admire your sense of humor, Mr. Keating.
Things like this aren't being done.
That's not what you mean at all, Mr. Keating. You mean they're being done all the time, but not talked about.
I didn't think.
You thought it before you came here. You didn't mind. I grant you I'm behaving abominably. I'm breaking all the rules of charity. It's extremely cruel, to be honest.
Please, Mr. Winant, let's drop it.
I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
That's simple. You're supposed to slap my face.
Keating giggled.
You were supposed to do that several minutes ago.
Keating noticed that his palms were wet, and that he was trying to support his weight by holding on to the napkin on his lap.
Winant and Dominique were eating, slowly and graciously, as if they were at another table.
Keating thought that they were not human bodies. Either one of them. Something had vanished.
The light of the crystal fixtures in the room was the radiance of X-rays that ate through, not to the bones, but deeper. They were souls, he thought, sitting at a dinner table, souls held within evening clothes, lacking the intermediate shape of flesh, terrifying in naked revelation, terrifying because he expected to see torturers, but saw a great innocence. He wondered what they saw. What his own clothes contained if his physical shape had gone.
No, said Winant. You don't want to do that, Mr. Keating. But of course you don't have to. Just say that you don't want any of it. I won't mind. There's Mr. Ralston Holcomb across the room. He could build Stone Ridge as well as you could.
I don't know what you mean, Mr. Winant, whispered Keating. His eyes were fixed upon the tomato aspic on his salad plate. It was soft and shivering. It made him sick.
Winant turned to Dominique. Do you remember our conversation about a certain quest, Mrs. Keating? I said it was a quest at which you would never succeed. Look at your husband. He's an expert, without effort. That is the way to go about it. Match that sometime. Don't bother to tell me that you can't. I know it. You're an amateur, my dear.
Keating thought that he must speak again, but he couldn't. Not as long as that salad was there before him. The terror came from that plate, not from the fastidious monster across the table. The rest of the room was warm and safe. He lurched forward, and his elbow swept the plate off the table. He made a kind of sound expressing regrets. Somebody's shape came up, there were polite voices of apology, and the mess vanished from the carpet. Keating heard a voice saying, "Why are you doing this?" Saw two faces turned to him, and knew that he had said it. "Mr. Wynand is not doing it to torture you, Peter," said Dominique calmly. "He's doing it for me, to see how much I can take."
"That's true, Mrs. Keating," said Wynand. "Partly true. The other part is to justify myself."
"In whose eyes?"
"Yours. And my own, perhaps."
"Do you need to?"
"Sometimes. The Banner is a contemptible paper, isn't it? Well, I have paid with my honor for the privilege of holding a position where I can amuse myself by observing how honor operates in other men."
His own clothes, thought Keating, contained nothing now, because the two faces did not notice him any longer. He was safe. His place at that table was empty. He wondered from a great indifferent distance why the two were looking at each other quietly, not like enemies, not like fellow executioners, but like comrades. 2 days before they were to sail, Wynand telephoned Dominique late in the evening. "Could you come over right now?" he asked, and hearing a moment's silence, added, "Oh, not what you're thinking. I live up to my agreements. You'll be quite safe. I just would like to see you tonight."
"All right," she said,
and was astonished to hear a quiet, "Thank you." When the elevator door slid open in the private lobby of his penthouse, he was waiting there, but did not let her step out. He joined her in the elevator.
"I don't want you to enter my house," he said. "We're going to the floor below."
The elevator operator looked at him, amazed. The car stopped and opened before a locked door. Wynand unlocked it and let her step out first, following her into the art gallery. She remembered that this was the place no outsider ever entered. She said nothing. He offered no explanation. For hours she walked silently through the vast rooms, looking at the incredible treasures of beauty. There was a deep carpet and no sound of steps, no sounds from the city outside, no windows. He followed her, stopping when she stopped. His eyes went with hers from object to object. At times his glance moved to her face. She passed, without stopping, by the statue from the Stoddard Temple. He did not urge her to stay, nor to hurry, as if he had turned the place over to her. She decided when she wished to leave, and he followed her to the door. Then she asked, "Why did you want me to see this? It won't make me think better of you. Worse, perhaps."
"Yes. I'd expect that," he said quietly, "if I had thought of it that way. But I didn't. I just wanted you to see it."
Chapter 4. The sun had set when they stepped out of the car in the spread of sky and sea, a green sky over a sheet of mercury. Tracings of fire remained at the edges of the clouds and in the brass fittings of the yacht. The yacht was like a white streak of motion, a sensitive body strained against the curb of stillness. Dominique looked at the gold letters, "I do," on the delicate white bow.
"What does that name mean?" she asked.
"It's an answer," said Wynand, "to people long since dead, though perhaps they are the only immortal ones. You see, the sentence I heard most often in my childhood was, 'You don't run things around here.'"
She remembered hearing that he had never answered this question before. He had answered her at once. He had not seemed conscious of making an exception. She felt a sense of calm in his manner, strange and new to him, an air of quiet finality. When they went aboard, the yacht started moving, almost as if Wynand's steps on deck had served as contact.
He stood at the rail, not touching her. He looked at the long brown shore that rose and fell against the sky, moving away from them. Then he turned to her. She saw no new recognition in his eyes, no beginning, but only the continuation of a glance, as if he had been looking at her all the time. When they went below, he walked with her into her cabin. He said, "Please let me know if there's anything you wish," and walked out through an inside door. She saw that it led to his bedroom. He closed the door and did not return. She moved idly across the cabin. A smear of reflection followed her on the lustrous surfaces of the pale satinwood paneling. She stretched out in a low armchair, her ankles crossed, her arms thrown behind her head, and watched the porthole turning from green to a dark blue. She moved her hand, switched on a light. The blue vanished and became a glazed black circle. The steward announced dinner. Wynand knocked at her door and accompanied her to the dining salon. His manner puzzled her. It was gay, but the sense of calm in the gaiety suggested a peculiar earnestness. She asked when they were seated at the table, "Why did you leave me alone?"
"I thought you might want to be alone."
"To get used to the idea?"
"If you wish to put it that way."
"I was used to it before I came to your office."
"Yes, of course. Forgive me for implying any weakness in you. I know better. By the way, you haven't asked me where we're going."
"That, too, would be weakness."
"True. I'm glad you don't care, because I never have any definite destination. The ship is not for going to places, but for getting away from them. When I stop at a port, it's only for the sheer pleasure of leaving it. I always think, here's one more spot that can't hold me."
"I used to travel a great deal. I always felt just like that. I've been told it's because I'm a hater of mankind."
"You're not foolish enough to believe that, are you?"
"I don't know."
"Surely you've seen through that particular stupidity. I mean the one that claims the pig is the symbol of love for humanity, the creature that accepts anything. As a matter of fact, the person who loves everybody and feels at home everywhere is the true hater of mankind. He expects nothing of men, so no form of depravity can outrage him."
"You mean the person who says that there's some good in the worst of us?"
"I mean the person who has the filthy insolence to claim that he loves equally the man who made that statue of you and the man who makes a Mickey Mouse balloon to sell on street corners. I mean the person who loves the men who prefer the Mickey Mouse to your statue, and there are many of that kind. I mean the person who loves Joan of Arc and the salesgirls in dress shops on Broadway with an equal fervor. I mean the person who loves your beauty and the women he sees in a subway, the kind that can't cross their knees and show flesh hanging publicly over their garters, with the same sense of exaltation. I mean the person who loves the clean, steady, unfrightened eyes of man looking through a telescope and the white stare of an imbecile, equally. I mean quite a large, generous, magnanimous company. Is it you who hate mankind, Mrs. Keating?"
"You're saying all the things that, since I can remember, since I began to see and think, have been..."
She stopped. "Have been torturing you, of course. One can't love man without hating most of the creatures who pretend to bear his name. It's one or the other. One doesn't love God and sacrilege impartially, except when one doesn't know that sacrilege has been committed, because one doesn't know God."
"What will you say if I give you the answer people usually give me? That love is forgiveness?"
"I'll say it's an indecency of which you're not capable, even though you think you're an expert in such matters."
"Or that love is pity."
"Oh, keep still. It's bad enough to hear things like that. To hear them from you is revolting, even as a joke."
"What's your answer?"
"That love is reverence and worship and glory and the upward glance, not a bandage for dirty sores. But they don't know it. Those who speak of love most promiscuously are the ones who've never felt it. They make some sort of feeble stew out of sympathy, compassion, contempt, and general indifference, and they call it love. Once you've felt what it means to love as you and I know it, the total passion for the total height, you're incapable of anything less."
"As you and I know it?"
"It's what we feel when we look at a thing like your statue. There's no forgiveness in that, and no pity, and I'd want to kill the man who claims that there should be. But you see, when he looks at your statue, he feels nothing. That, or a dog with a broken paw. It's all the same to him. He even feels that he's done something nobler by bandaging the dog's paw than by looking at your statue. So if you seek a glimpse of greatness, if you want exaltation, if you ask for God and refuse to accept the washing of wounds as substitute, you're called a hater of humanity, Mrs. Keating, because you've committed the crime of knowing a love humanity has not learned to deserve.
Mr. Wynand, have you read what I got fired for?
No, I didn't then. I don't dare to now.
Why?
He ignored the question. He said, smiling, "And so you came to me and said, 'You're the vilest person on earth. Take me, so that I'll learn self-contempt. I lack that which most people live by. They find life endurable while I can't.' Do you see now what you've shown?"
"I didn't expect it to be seen."
"No, not by the publisher of the New York Banner, of course. That's all right. I expected a beautiful slut who is a friend of Ellsworth Toohey." They laughed together. She thought it was strange that they could talk without strain, as if he had forgotten the purpose of this journey. His calm had become a contagious sense of peace between them. She watched the unobtrusively gracious way their dinner was served. She looked at the white tablecloth against the deep red of the mahogany walls. Everything on the yacht had an air that made her think it was the first truly luxurious place she had ever entered. The luxury was secondary, a background so proper to him that it could be ignored. The man humbled his own wealth. She had seen people of wealth, stiff and awed before that which represented their ultimate goal. The splendor of this place was not the aim, not the final achievement of the man who leaned casually across the table. She wondered what his aim had been.
"This ship is becoming to you," she said.
She saw a look of pleasure in his eyes, and of gratitude. "Thank you. Is the art gallery?"
"Yes. Only that's less excusable."
"I don't want you to make excuses for me." He said it simply, without reproach. They had finished dinner. She waited for the inevitable invitation. It did not come. He sat smoking, talking about the yacht and the ocean. Her hand came to rest accidentally on the tablecloth, close to his. She saw him looking at it. She wanted to jerk her hand away, but forced herself to let it lie still. "Now," she thought. He got up. "Let's go on deck," he said. They stood at the rail and looked at a black void. Space was not to be seen, only felt by the quality of the air against their faces. A few stars gave reality to the empty sky. A few sparks of white fire in the water gave life to the ocean. He stood, slouched carelessly, one arm raised, grasping a stanchion. She saw the sparks flowing, forming the edges of waves, framed by the curve of his body. That, too, was becoming to him. She said, "May I name another vicious bromide you've never felt?"
"Which one?"
"You've never felt how small you were when looking at the ocean." He laughed.
"Never. Nor looking at the planets, nor at mountain peaks, nor at the Grand Canyon. Why should I? When I look at the ocean, I feel the greatness of man. I think of man's magnificent capacity that created this ship to conquer all that senseless space. When I look at mountain peaks, I think of tunnels and dynamite. When I look at the planets, I think of airplanes."
"Yes. And that particular sense of sacred rapture men say they experience in contemplating nature. I've never received it from nature, only from..."
She stopped. "From what?"
"Buildings," she whispered. "Skyscrapers."
"Why didn't you want to say that?"
"I don't know."
"I would give the greatest sunset in the world for one side of New York's skyline, particularly when one can't see the details, just the shapes. The shapes and the thought that made them. The sky over New York and the will of man made visible. What other religion do we need? And then people tell me about pilgrimages to some dank pest hole in a jungle where they go to do homage to a crumbling temple, to a leering stone monster with a pot belly created by some leprous savage. Is it beauty and genius they want to see?"
"Did
Do they seek a sense of the sublime? Let them come to New York, stand on the shore of the Hudson, look and kneel. When I see the city from my window, no, I don't feel how small I am, but I feel that if a war came to threaten this, I would like to throw myself into space, over the city, and protect those buildings with my body.
Gail, I don't know whether I'm listening to you or to myself.
Did you hear yourself just now?
She smiled.
Actually not. But I won't take it back, Gail. Thank you, Dominique. His voice was soft and amused.
But we weren't talking about you or me. We were talking about other people.
He leaned with both forearms on the rail. He spoke, watching the sparks in the water.
It's interesting to speculate on the reasons that make men so anxious to debase themselves. As in that idea of feeling small before nature. It's not a bromide. It's practically an institution. Have you noticed how self-righteous a man sounds when he tells you about it? Look, he seems to say, I'm so glad to be a pygmy. That's how virtuous I am. Have you heard with what delight people quote some great celebrity who's proclaimed that he's not so great when he looks at Niagara Falls? It's as if they were smacking their lips in sheer glee that their best is dust before the brute force of an earthquake. As if they were sprawling on all fours, rubbing their foreheads in the mud to the majesty of a hurricane. But that's not the spirit that leashed fire, steam, electricity, that crossed oceans in sailing sloops, that built airplanes and dams and skyscrapers. What is it they fear? What is it they hate so much, those who love to crawl? And why?
When I find the answer to that, she said, I'll make my peace with the world.
He went on talking, of his travels, of the continents beyond the darkness around them, the darkness that made of space a soft curtain pressed against their eyelids. She waited. She stopped answering. She gave him a chance to use the brief silences for ending this, for saying the words she expected. He would not say them.
Are you tired, my dear? He asked.
No.
I'll get you a deck chair if you want to sit down.
No, I like standing here.
It's a little cold. But by tomorrow we'll be far south, and then you'll see the ocean on fire at night. It's very beautiful.
He was silent. She heard the ship's speed and the sound of the water, the rustling moan of protest against the thing that cut a long wound across the water's surface.
When are we going below? She asked.
We're not going below.
He had said it quietly, with an odd kind of simplicity, as if he were standing helpless before a fact he could not alter.
Will you marry me? He asked.
She could not hide the shock. He had seen it in advance. He was smiling quietly, understanding.
It would be best to say nothing else.
He spoke carefully.
But you prefer to hear it stated, because that kind of silence between us is more than I have a right to expect. You don't want to tell me much, but I've spoken for you tonight, so let me speak for you again. You've chosen me as the symbol of your contempt for men. You don't love me. You wish to grant me nothing. I'm only your tool of self-destruction. I know all that. I accept it. And I want you to marry me. If you wish to commit an unspeakable act as your revenge against the world, such an act is not to sell yourself to your enemy, but to marry him. Not to match your worst against his worst, but your worst against his best. You've tried that once, but your victim wasn't worthy of your purpose. You see, I'm pleading my case in your own terms. What mine are, what I want to find in that marriage, is of no importance to you, and I shall regard it in that manner. You don't have to know about it. You don't have to consider it. I exact no promises and impose no obligations on you. You'll be free to leave me whenever you wish. Incidentally, since it is of no concern to you, I love you.
She stood, one arm stretched behind her, fingertips pressed to the rail. She said,
I did not want that.
I know. But if you're curious about it, I'll tell you that you've made a mistake. You let me see the cleanest person I've ever seen.
Isn't that ridiculous, after the way we met?
Dominique,
I've spent my life pulling the strings of the world. I've seen all of it. Do you think I could believe any purity, unless it came to me twisted in some such dreadful shape as the one you chose? But what I feel must not affect your decision. She stood looking at him, looking incredulously at all the hours past. Her mouth had the shape of gentleness. He saw it. She thought that every word he said today had been of her language, that this offer and the form he gave it were of her own world, and that he had destroyed his purpose by it, taken away from her the motive he suggested, made it impossible to seek degradation with a man who spoke as he did. She wanted suddenly to reach for him, to tell him everything, to find a moment's release in his understanding, then ask him never to see her again. Then she remembered. He noticed the movement of her hand. Her fingers were not leaning tensely against the rail, betraying a need of support, giving importance to the moment. They relaxed and closed about the rail, as if she had taken hold of some reins, carelessly, because the occasion required no earnest effort any longer. She remembered the Stoddard Temple. She thought of the man before her, who spoke about the total passion for the total height, and about protecting skyscrapers with his body. And she saw a picture on a page of the New York Banner, a picture of Howard Rourke looking up at the Enright House, and the caption, "Are you happy, Mr. Superman?" She raised her face to him. She asked, "To marry you? To become Mrs. Winand Papers?" She heard the effort in his voice as he answered, "If you wish to call it that, yes." "I will marry you." "Thank you, Dominique." She waited indifferently. When he turned to her, he spoke as he had spoken all day, a calm voice with an edge of gaiety. "We'll cut the cruise short. We'll take just a week. I want to have you here for a while. You'll leave for Reno the day after we return. I'll take care of your husband. He can have Stone Ridge and anything else he wants, and may God damn him. We'll be married the day you come back." "Yes, Gail." "Now let's go below." "Do you want it?" "No. But I don't want our marriage to be important." "I want it to be important, Dominique. That's why I won't touch you tonight. Not until we're married. I know it's a senseless gesture. I know that a wedding ceremony has no significance for either one of us. But to be conventional is the only abnormality possible between us. That's why I want it. I have no other way of making an exception." "As you wish, Gail." Then he pulled her to him, and he kissed her mouth. It was the completion of his words, the finished statement, a statement of such intensity that she tried to stiffen her body, not to respond, and felt her body responding, forced to forget everything but the physical fact of a man who held her. He let her go. She knew he had noticed. He smiled and said, "You're tired, Dominique. Shall I say good night? I want to remain here for a while." She turned obediently and walked alone down to her cabin. Chapter 5.
"What's the matter? Don't I get Stone Ridge?" snapped Peter Keating.
Dominique walked into the living room. He followed, waiting in the open door. The elevator boy brought in her luggage and left. She said, removing her gloves, "You'll get Stone Ridge, Peter. Mr. Winand will tell you the rest himself. He wants to see you tonight, at 8:30, at his home."
"Why in hell?"
"He'll tell you." She slapped her gloves softly against her palm, a small gesture of finality, like a period at the end of a sentence. She turned to leave the room. He stood in her way.
"I don't care," he said. "I don't give a damn. I can play it your way. You're great, aren't you? Because you act like truck drivers, you and Mr. Gale Winand. To hell with decency, to hell with the other fellow's feelings. Well, I can do that, too. I'll use you both, and I'll get what I can out of it. And that's all I care. How do you like it? No point when the worm refuses to be hurt. Spoils the fun."
"I think that's much better, Peter. I'm glad."
He found himself unable to preserve this attitude when he entered Winan's study that evening. He could not escape the awe of being admitted into Gail Winan's home. By the time he crossed the room to the seat facing the desk, he felt nothing but a sense of weight, and he wondered whether his feet had left prints on the soft carpet, like the leaded feet of a deep-sea diver. "What I have to tell you, Mr. Keating, should never have needed to be said or done," said Winan. Keating had never heard a man speak in a manner so consciously controlled. He thought crazily that it sounded as if Winand held his fist closed over his voice and directed each syllable. "Any extra word I speak will be offensive, so I shall be brief. I am going to marry your wife. She is leaving for Reno tomorrow. Here is the contract for Stone Ridge. I have signed it. Attached is a check for $250,000. It is in addition to what you will receive for your work under the contract. I'll appreciate it if you will now make no comment of any kind. I realize that I could have had your consent for less, but I wish no discussion. It would be intolerable if we were to bargain about it. Therefore, will you please take this and consider the matter settled?" He extended the contract across the desk. Keating saw the pale blue rectangle of the check held to the top of the page by a paperclip. The clip flashed silver in the light of the desk lamp. Keating's hand did not reach to meet the paper. He said, his chin moving awkwardly to frame the words, "I don't want it. You can have my consent for nothing." He saw a look of astonishment, and almost of kindness on Winan's face. "You don't want it? You don't want Stone Ridge either?"
"I want Stone Ridge!"
Keating's hand rose and snatched the paper.
"I want it all. Why should you get away with it? Why should I care?"
Winand got up. He said, relief and regret in his voice,
"Right, Mr. Keating. For a moment you had almost justified your marriage. Let it remain what it was. Good night."
Keating did not go home. He walked to the apartment of Neil Dumont, his new designer and best friend. Neil Dumont was a lanky, anemic society youth, with shoulders stooped under the burden of too many illustrious ancestors. He was not a good designer, but he had connections. He was obsequious to Keating in the office, and Keating was obsequious to him after office hours. He found Dumont at home. Together they got Gordon Prescott and Vincent Knowlton, and started out to make a wild night of it. Keating did not drink much. He paid for everything. He paid more than necessary. He seemed anxious to find things to pay for. He gave exorbitant tips. He kept asking, "We're friends. Aren't we friends? Aren't we?" He looked at the glasses around him, and he watched the lights dancing in the liquid. He looked at the three pairs of eyes. They were blurred, but they turned upon him occasionally with contentment. They were soft and comforting. That evening, her bags packed and ready in her room, Dominique went to see Stephen Mallory. She had not seen Rourke for 20 months. She had called on Mallory once in a while. Mallory knew that these visits were breakdowns in a struggle she would not name. He knew that she did not want to come, that her rare evenings with him were time torn out of her life. He never asked any questions, and he was always glad to see her. They talked quietly, with a feeling of companionship, such as that of an old married couple, as if he had possessed her body, and the wonder of it had long since been consumed, and nothing remained but an untroubled intimacy. He had never touched her body, but he had possessed it in a deeper kind of ownership when he had done her statue, and they could not lose the special sense of each other it had given them. He smiled when he opened the door and saw her. "Hello, Dominique."
"Hello, Steve. Interrupting you?"
"No, come in." He had a studio, a huge, sloppy place in an old building. She noticed the change since her last visit. The room had an air of laughter, like a breath held too long and released. She saw second-hand furniture, an oriental rug of rare texture and sensuous color, jade ashtrays, pieces of sculpture that came from historical excavations, anything he had wished to seize, helped by the sudden fortune of Winan's patronage. The walls looked strangely bare above the gay clutter. He had bought no paintings. A single sketch hung over his studio. Rourke's original drawing of the Stoddard Temple. She looked slowly about her, noting every object and the reason for its presence. She kicked two chairs toward the fireplace, and they sat down, one at each side of the fire. He said quite simply, "Clayton, Ohio."
"Doing what?"
"A new building for Janer's department store, 5 stories, on Main Street."
"How long has he been there?"
"About a month." It was the first question he answered whenever she came here, without making her ask it. His simple ease spared her the necessity of explanation or pretense. His manner included no comment.
"I'm going away tomorrow, Steve."
"For long?"
"6 weeks." "Reno."
"I'm glad."
"I'd rather not tell you now what I'll do when I come back."
"You won't be glad." "I'll try to be, if it's what you want to do."
"It's what I want to do."
One log still kept its shape on the pile of coals in the fireplace. It was checkered into small squares, and it glowed without flame like a solid string of lighted windows. He reached down and threw a fresh log on the coals. It cracked the string of windows in half and sent sparks, shooting up against the sooted bricks. He talked about his own work. She listened, as if she were an emigrant, hearing her homeland's language for a brief while. In a pause, she asked,
"How is he, Steve?"
"As he's always been. He doesn't change, you know." He kicked the log. A few coals rolled out. He pushed them back. He said, "I often think that he's the only one of us who's achieved immortality. I don't mean in the sense of fame, and I don't mean that he won't die someday, but he's living it. I think he is what the conception really means. You know how people long to be eternal, but they die with every day that passes. When you meet them, they're not what you met last. In any given hour, they kill some part of themselves. They change, they deny, they contradict, and they call it growth. At the end, there's nothing left, nothing unreversed or unbetrayed, as if there had never been any entity, only a succession of adjectives fading in and out on an unformed mass. But how do they expect a permanence which they have never held for a single moment? But Howard, one can imagine him existing forever." She sat looking at the fire. It gave a deceptive semblance of life to her face. After a while, he asked, "How do you like all the new things I got?"
"I like them. I like your having them.
I didn't tell you what happened to me since I saw you last. The completely incredible." "Gail Winant."
"Yes, I know about that."
"You do?" "Winant, of all people. What on earth made him discover me?"
"I know that, too. I'll tell you when I come back."
"He has an amazing judgment." "Amazing for him. He bought the best."
"Yes, he would."
Then she asked, without transition, yet he knew that she was not speaking of Winant.
"Steve, has he ever asked you about me?"
"No."
"Have you told him about my coming here?"
"No."
"Is that for my sake, Steve?"
"No. For his." He knew he had told her everything she wanted to know. She said, rising,
"Let's have some tea. Show me where you keep your stuff, I'll fix it."